You are listening to the Forgotten News Podcast.
But before we begin, here are a few words about a couple of other podcasts that we think you might want to try.
Do you love a good old-fashioned mystery? If so, you'll love my podcast, The Great Detectives of Old Time Radio. 6 days a week, we bring you a different detective program from the golden age of radio. We listen to the episode, and I share my thoughts and respond to your feedback. Check us out at greatdetectives.net.
Hi guys, it's Heaven from Just a Girl in True Crime. If you're like me, then you love true crime. And that's what this podcast is about. So, come with me on this journey while we decide to deep dive into crazy and heinous cases. I look forward to seeing you all there.
Welcome to the Forgotten News Podcast. This is your window to hear true stories from long ago. Stories that once made headlines. Stories that people thought would be unforgettable. Yet those stories were soon lost in the sands of time or were buried deep in the dustbin of history. In this podcast, we shake off the sand and dust from those stories and share them here with you, as fresh as the day they were first told.
And now, here's your hosts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode number 3 of the Forgotten News Podcast. And thank you for listening. My name is Jim, and I'm going to start by letting you know that I continue to be amazed by the number of people who have listened to this podcast in the short amount of time since it was launched on July the 19th. We have now had over 1,200 downloads from people listening to this show. So, with that in mind, let me again thank each and every one of you who are listening. I hope you will continue to listen in the future. And so, with no further ado, I guess it's time to move on to this week's episode. I'll begin at the beginning. I had promised on our last show that this episode would be a true crime case, and indeed, it is. In fact, I think I've decided that we will feature a true crime case on every second episode. So, in other words, just to be 100% clear, we will have a true crime episode followed by something completely different in the next episode. It might be something funny, it might be something weird or strange or mysterious, but it will definitely be something completely different than the topic of the previous one. And then our next episode will be another true crime case. Well, that's my tentative plan for the show. Hopefully, I'll be able to stick to that schedule, beginning with this episode. And so, here we go. First, since this will be a true crime episode, we will start with a warning to our listeners because of the nature of the story. Annabelle, would you please give the warning for our audience?
No problem, Jim. A warning to listeners. This episode will include brief descriptions of violence and tragedy.
Our featured story is a murder case that took place in 1891. It revolves around a man who was unfaithful to his wife and was killed as a result.
The specifics will be kept to the absolute minimum needed to tell a story in a historically accurate way. This is not a podcast that indulges in gruesome or gory details or foul language in regard to any topic. But even so, if you think that hearing about these things could possibly cause you to have a negative emotional reaction, then this episode might not be something you should listen to. In addition, the story that is being featured is definitely not recommended for children, since it could be upsetting or even frightening to young ears. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Okay. Thank you, Annabelle. And so, with all that having been said, on with the show. Our story begins in 1886 at Manhattan Beach in the Brooklyn community of New York City, when a 25-year-old widow named Ella Nelson meets a 32-year-old man named Samuel Post. Ella was pretty and petite and was living nearby with her brother. And at the time, Post was a traveling salesman for the Commonwealth Rubber Company. They soon began seeing each other regularly. Basically, the two of them were doing what we would now call dating. After a few months, Post decided that Ella should have an apartment of her own. So he rented one for her at 100 West 28th Street, and needless to say, they spent a lot of time there together. Unfortunately, it was not until a year later, when Ella started hinting about marriage, that Post finally told Ella that he couldn't marry her because he already had a wife and three children. Ella was not happy to learn this troublesome fact. But the two of them somehow managed to continue their unique relationship for another 4 years. However, sometime early in that fourth year, Ella discovered that Post had begun seeing another woman, and Ella told him in no uncertain terms that adding a girlfriend to their arrangement was entirely unacceptable. It was bad enough that he had a wife. Yet, despite the stern warning given by Ella, he continued to pursue the other woman. Ella soon found out, and she was definitely not okay with it. On the afternoon of February 18, 1891, she decided that Post was not going to be cheating on her ever again, and that his extracurricular activities were going to come to an immediate end. Post was put on notice very quickly when four gunshots rang out, and not long after, he was dead. Now, thankfully, there was a witness besides Ella to the chain of events that led to the shooting. A man named Nathan Michaels was a mutual friend of the two of them, whom Post had brought with him that afternoon. According to Michaels, the three of them were talking in a friendly way about this and that when Ella suddenly decided to mention a room that Post had recently rented at 248 West 24th Street. She called it a hole in the wall that Post had gotten so as to have a place to bring loose women behind her back. At this point, it appears that Post had made the fatal mistake of telling Ella that no, he had gotten the room so as to be able to break off his relationship with her. And that the only reason that he and Nathan Michaels had come over to the apartment that day was to get his clothes and belongings and then, After that, as far as he was concerned, she was on her own. Well, it may be needless to say, but this statement sparked a red-hot argument between Ella and Post, which continued when he went into the bedroom, apparently to get his clothes. After a few minutes, Michaels said he heard a gunshot. He then saw Post stumble out of the bedroom and heard him shout,
"Oh my God! I'm shot!"
Nathan Michaels then saw Ella storm into the parlor where she and Post stood face to face. She looked him straight in the eye and then fired at him 3 more times. Then she screamed at him.
"Now, damn you, I've got you now!"
There can be little doubt that Nathan Michaels saw and heard all of this happen. He had been sitting a mere 6 feet away on a piano stool. He somehow pulled himself together and ran out of the building to try to find a cop or a doctor or both. Ella would later claim that the gunshots were the accidental result of a struggle between her and Post over the gun. But there was no evidence of a struggle, and she did not have a scratch on her anywhere. Meanwhile, out on the street, Nathan Michaels had been able to quickly find not one, but 2 policemen, and one of the cops immediately called a nearby hospital and arranged for a doctor to be sent, who managed to arrive at the apartment at almost the same time as the cops. When they walked through the door, the first thing they saw was Ella, with the gun still in her hand, standing over the heavily bleeding body of Samuel Post and smiling, almost as if she was admiring her work. When the police approached and spoke to Post, he refused to give his name, so they simply listed him as John Smith. And under that name, he was later admitted for treatment at New York Hospital. His real name was not discovered until after the police spoke to the woman holding the gun, Ella Nelson. But before that happened, the cops first told the doctor to examine Post, and they left him to do his work while they attempted to speak with Ella. Unfortunately, the cops soon learned that Ella had very little memory of anything. And her memory would not get any better as time went on, either. Meanwhile, the doctor introduced himself to Post, who responded with a joke.
"I guess Ella made a bullseye this time."
After the doctor was done, the 2 cops walked over to Post, and one of them asked if he knew who shot him. In front of both of them, he identified Ella as the shooter. At this point, the cops arrested her. Post was taken to the hospital, where he was asked to tell exactly what happened. He gave this explanation.
"When I told her I was leaving, she said to me, 'You're not going away.' I said, 'Yes, I am going away.' Then I heard the pistol, bang, bang, and felt a pain in my abdomen."
At the hospital, it was found that Post had received a pistol shot wound on the right side of his abdomen, and that his only chance of recovery was dependent upon the successful result of a difficult and dangerous operation. The operation was performed, and it seemed to have been successful. Post was in relatively good spirits afterward, and the doctors were greatly encouraged. Nevertheless, the condition of the patient was still so serious that the police summoned the coroner to the hospital to take a statement from Post as to the chain of events that led to the shooting. Post told the coroner that after living with Nelson for 5 years, he had made up his mind to leave her so he took a room on 24th Street, intending to occupy it until he could make a full reconciliation with his wife. He told the coroner,
"I wanted to go back to the wife that I had wronged and lead a better life."
Post further said that on Wednesday afternoon, in company with his friend Nathan Michaels, he went to the apartment to get his clothes and other articles, and that then, after he went into the bedroom and started gathering his things and getting ready to leave, Ella confronted him and declared that he wasn't going anywhere and shot him 4 times with a pistol. 1 shot was in the bedroom and the other 3 times in the parlor. Post said that her first shot had hit him in the abdomen. He also said that it wasn't the first time that Ella had threatened him, and that it also wasn't the first time that she had shot at him. Now, listeners, at this point, you would be completely justified in thinking that this was an open and shut case, and that the best Ella could do would be to throw herself on the mercy of the prosecutors and the court. Except that Ella had the good sense to get in touch with the law firm of Howe and Hummel, who, at the time, were the best known criminal defense attorneys in New York, perhaps even in the country as a whole. They had a widespread reputation for being willing to say or do anything to win a case. This was a law firm with very flexible ethics, when they thought about ethics at all, which was rarely. Oh, and speaking of Howe and Hummel, let me tell you, this will not be the last time that we will have an episode that features the unique talents of this particular law firm. There will be another episode somewhere in the fairly near future that will do an even better job of showcasing their unusual legal skills. Wait and see. These guys were just unbelievable. The founder of the firm was William Howe, who had been born in Massachusetts but had been raised as a boy in England and moved to New York at age 21. Almost as soon as he arrived and found a place to live, he began studying to become a lawyer and was admitted to the bar in 1857. He quickly became very skilled at handling and winning cases on behalf of criminal defendants, and he soon became famous for his abilities in this regard. In addition, he was an extremely imposing figure in any courtroom. He was over 6 feet tall and weighed more than 325 pounds. He never lost his English Cockney accent. Some say it helped him to convince juries, especially when he had no facts or evidence to back up his arguments. Big Bill Howe personally handled nearly all of the criminal cases for the firm. It was work that he enjoyed doing. And, as the old saying says, success breeds success. And, by the time the 1890s rolled around, his law firm represented over 90% of all felony defendants in New York. So, with all that being said, it was no surprise that once Ella Nelson was arrested and charged with the murder of Samuel Post, she almost immediately contacted Howe and Hummel, who agreed to represent her. Well, one thing I could say for certain about Ella's new attorney, William Howe, he was no fool, and after looking over the details of the case and the statements of the witnesses, he saw no path to victory. Instead, he saw a total dead end. Howe decided that his best bet was to try to persuade the district attorney, a man named Francis Wellman, that Ella Nelson had just suddenly overreacted to her betrayal by her boyfriend. So the accusation of murder was inappropriate, and that the charges against her should be reduced to a simple misdemeanor, assault and battery. When the district attorney practically laughed out loud at that suggestion, Hal cleared his throat and then said that he thought he could convince Ella to plead guilty to manslaughter. After listening, District Attorney Wellman looked at Hal and said, "No thanks, but if you'd like to wrap up the case by having her plead guilty to something, he'd accept a plea of second-degree murder." Wellman took this hard-nosed position because he saw no reason to bargain, since, from his point of view, this was a case with literally no disadvantage for the prosecution. In addition, the confidence of the district attorney was further reinforced by the fact that the judge would be Frederick Smith, an unsmiling former prosecutor with a reputation for being intimidating towards defense attorneys in criminal cases. For example, a man named Tom Nolan, a New York lawyer who had been raised in Ireland, was a person with a great deal of experience in the courtroom of Judge Smith. And he once said this about the judge to a newspaper reporter.
"He is a good judge, a fine judge, but he thinks every man ought to go to prison at least once."
Nevertheless, despite the uphill battle he faced, Hal knew that there was no way that Ella would be willing to plead guilty to second-degree murder. So, his meeting with District Attorney Wellman came to an abrupt end, and the case was scheduled for trial. A trial that even Big Bill Hal thought would be a hopeless cause for his client. But little did Hal know at the time that this trial, this apparent hopeless cause, would soon become his most famous case. In fact, it became so famous that when Bill Hal passed away while sleeping in his bed in 1902, every single newspaper that wrote about his death mentioned the outcome of this case as the highlight of his career. So, what happened? What transformed this case? Well, listeners, I'll tell you. Big Bill Hal knew what he was facing in Judge Smith's court. So, when he opened for the defense, he immediately took the offense. He challenged every statement that the dying Samuel Post had made. He ridiculed the testimony of Nathan Michaels and insulted the victim as, quote, "a double-dyed scoundrel," unquote, and described his client as, quote, "a respectable widow," unquote, a naive young woman who had been tricked into becoming the mistress of, quote, "a base wife deserter," unquote. Howe took every opportunity to argue that Ella had only accidentally pulled the trigger on Post, the man she loved, and still loved. It had all just been a mistake. It could have happened to anyone. He hammered these points home with all the emotion he could muster, such as when he argued to the jury,
"Who shall dare to say whether it was the hand of that man or the hand of this poor unfortunate woman that pulled the fatal trigger?"
Throughout all of this, and actually throughout the entire trial, Ella Nelson, wearing a faded black dress, cried continuously with reddened eyes and a seemingly nonstop flow of tears. When it came time for Ella to testify, she slowly made her way to the witness stand, weeping the entire time. She told her version of what happened, tearfully whimpering that she had become upset because she suspected that Post had become romantically involved with yet another woman.
I told him that he ruined his wife's life and my life, and now he wanted to ruin another woman's life.
According to Ella, it was Post who grabbed and pointed the pistol.
We had a scuffle over the pistol, and it went off.
And then Ella, still on the stand, was asked, what happened next? Ella basically said she didn't know.
I was sort of crazy, and when I come to my senses, he was lying on the floor with his head in my lap.
William Howe thereupon ended his soft velvet questioning of Ella, but she remained on the witness stand for cross-examination by District Attorney Wellman. She wept even harder during Wellman's questions, yet somehow Ella managed to stick to her simple story. There was a gun, there was a struggle over it, some shots happened, and then her mind went blank.
I don't know how the pistol went off. I don't know anything about it. I never had the pistol in my hand.
The trial eventually neared its end, with Ella weeping throughout. In his closing statement, William Howe spoke with every bit of passion, dramatic flair, and oratorical skill that he could think of. He reiterated and underlined all of the arguments that he had been making, and added new ones that came into his mind as he spoke. Big Bill argued that Samuel Post was a seducer of multiple women. If he had escaped death, one innocent girl after another would have become his victim. He deserved what had happened to him. And this Nathan Michaels, he was a pal of Samuel Post, so there was no reason for anyone to believe anything that he said. Not only that, Howe pointed out every tiny inconsistency in the testimony of the witnesses, which enabled him to say that they were all in conflict with each other, so Ella Nelson was clearly deserving of reasonable doubt in her favor. In addition, Howe reminded the jury, it would be an awful thing to send a woman, any woman, to her death in the electric chair. In short, William Howe pulled out all of his usual strategy and tactics from his enormous bag of tricks. Then, an idea came to him. He walked over to the sobbing Ella and said,
"Can you live with the specter of this woman haunting you all your days, can you? Look at her face."
Unfortunately, this was not possible, because Ella's face was buried in her hands. So, Howe leaned over and pulled her hands away, then dug his fingernails into the soft skin of her wrists. Ella's head jerked up as she uttered a loud shriek. The jury immediately saw the pained expression on her face, and Big Bill Howe saw his chance. He raised his voice and pointed his finger at the jury.
"Can you say I sent her to a felon's doom?"
After that, it was the turn of District Attorney Francis Wellman to speak. He gave a reasonable, careful summary of the evidence and the reasons why Ella should be convicted. But, like it or not, Wellman knew it was too late. The shriek had changed everything. And he was right. William Howe, with Ella's help, had managed to reach the raw instinct of the all-male jury to protect innocent womanhood. And in that courtroom, Ella Nelson suddenly represented all of innocent womanhood everywhere. For that jury, she represented their daughters, their sisters, and every innocent girl who had ever been taken advantage of. And the district attorney knew that he was about to lose the case. He later told what happened right before his eyes.
It would be impossible to describe the effect this unearthly shriek had upon me. It was as if someone had suddenly put a lump of ice down my back. The jury seemed completely petrified by it, and I saw that the case was over from that moment.
Well, I have nothing to add to that statement of the situation as given from the standpoint of the district attorney. But the wheels of justice continued to turn. The judge sent the jury out of the room to make a decision. And after 3 hours of deliberation, including a long dinner break, they came back with their verdict.
Not guilty.
When Ella heard that verdict, she was so stunned, she actually stopped weeping and fell into the surprised arms of Big Bill Howe. The jury members later explained that they had considered what Samuel Post had said in his dying declaration, but that Post had only said that he heard the shots from the pistol, but that he didn't say that Ella had fired those shots. And, for no obvious reason, the jury also decided not to believe Nathan Michaels, the only eyewitness. Thus, once the words of those two individuals were excluded, the members of the jury really had nothing left to decide, except for reasonable doubt in favor of Ella. And so, it was a straight line from there to a not guilty verdict. The outcome of the case was truly emotionally shattering to District Attorney Francis Wellman. That night, he couldn't sleep. The next day, he locked himself in his office and refused to speak to anyone. And when Wellman wrote his autobiography 33 years later, he was still filled with pent-up anger and rage towards William Howe, even though he had been dead for over 20 years. His written words about the case practically dripped with venom as he recalled what had taken place that day in 1891. But, in contrast to the pain felt by the district attorney, William Howe and his law partner, Abraham Hummel, spent the next day celebrating the unexpected victory at a very expensive restaurant near their office. They were quite a striking pair whenever they were seen in public together. As I previously mentioned, Big Bill Howe weighed over 325 pounds and he was more than 6 feet tall. His partner, Hummel, was barely 5 feet tall, even when he wore platform shoes, which was always. He weighed less than 100 pounds and was rail thin. The two of them ran into quite a few lawyers that day, both at the restaurant and on the street, and they practically basked in congratulations for winning the case that should have been impossible to win. And, you might wonder, where was Ella Nelson while all this was going on? I will tell you. And the answer is shocking. She completely disappears from the pages of history. Well, almost completely. Personally, I wondered whatever became of her. So, I looked in the records of the U.S. Census for 1900, which was the first census to take place in the years after the trial in 1891. According to the census information, Ella was again living with her brother. She was now working as a dressmaker. She was definitely no longer residing in the apartment that Samuel Post had set her up in, although she was still living in Brooklyn. And, sad to say, the name Ella Nelson does not appear in any other census or news article ever again. It is possible that she may have gotten married after the year 1900 and thus had a new name, and that might be the reason why I could not find her in any census following that year. And, of course, there is also a chance that she may have passed away between 1900 and the next census in 1910, considering that there was a much shorter life expectancy for people living in that time period. Or, maybe, she might just have moved away from New York City, and that is the reason why she doesn't show up in New York census records after 1900. Who knows? But, in a way, it is surprising to me that Ella literally disappeared from the face of the earth following the trial that had made her a household name at the time. Yet, it appears that no reporter from any newspaper ever thought to interview her. Not in 1891, the year of the trial, and not in any year after. And not even when William Howe passed away in 1902, and it was headline news in newspapers across the state of New York. By the way, just out of curiosity, I looked on Google Street View to see what is currently located at 100 West 28th Street in Brooklyn, the spot where pretty little Ella put four bullets into Samuel Post. There is a McDonald's there now. And I suppose it's always nice when the scene of a tragedy is replaced by something completely different.
Jim, can I add something?
Okay. Go ahead, Annabelle.
You were talking about the fact that the district attorney was really ticked off about the dirty tricks that Bill Howe used to win the Ella Nelson case. Well, here's a fun fact that our listeners might find interesting. About a year after the Ella Nelson case, there was another trial where Bill Howe again faced off against District Attorney Wellman. A young woman named Annie Walden had shot and killed her husband because she was mad at him about something or other. And when she went on trial for murder, D.A. Wellman anticipated that Bill Howe would use his usual tactic of trying to slam the victim, along with every other slick trick he could think of. Well, this time, the district attorney decided that he was not going to let Big Bill get away with it. During his opening statement at the trial, he warned the jury about practically everything they could expect to see and hear. He told them about the way that Big Bill would rehearse his clients, almost like they were preparing for a play, including getting them to cry, scream, or shriek if that would help him to win the case. Well, at this trial, the jury listened. Annie Walden was sent to prison for life. So, in other words, the result of the Annie Walden trial was the exact opposite of the outcome in the Ella Nelson case.
Thanks for sharing that, Annabelle. That was really interesting. Well, with all that having been said, and as you might have already guessed, we are now at the end of our story. So, all I can say is, my deepest thanks to the kind and wonderful podcasters who contributed their voice talents to this episode. Specifically, my sincerest gratitude to
Jeff
from the Everything is Awesome podcast,
Penny
from the Murder She Spoke podcast,
Bonnie
from the Bloody Murder podcast,
Frank
from the English Martial Arts podcast,
Mike
from the Pleasing Terrors podcast, and last but not least,
Nick
from the Concession Stand podcast. I have included their full names, voice credits, and links to their podcasts in the show notes. Once again, thanks. You have no idea how much I appreciate each of you who helped me out. I would also like to thank
Annabelle DC
for the audio bits that she contributed to this episode. By the way, as I have said on previous occasions, Annabelle is a very talented voice performer. If you think you might be able to use her voice and vocal skills for anything whatsoever, you can reach her at
AnnabelleAudios@hotmail.com.
And that's Annabelle with only one N. I have included her contact information in the show notes in case you missed it or if you aren't sure about the spelling of her name or email address. And I definitely do not want to forget Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com for the music used on this episode. There are specific credits for him and his music in the show notes. If you have a podcast or anything else that you might need instrumental music for, be sure to check out Kevin's website, which offers a wide variety of music at absolutely no cost. I have a link in the show notes. And at this point, I also want to give the biggest thanks possible to you, my listeners. The incredibly great response that I have gotten has definitely given me tremendous encouragement to continue with this podcast. But I also have a favor to ask of you. Please take a moment and go to iTunes, also known as Apple Podcasts, and leave a rating and review for this show. It really helps out as far as helping to bring new listeners and public awareness of the podcast. And starting with our next episode, I will give a shout out on the show to anyone who leaves a review and also to anyone who makes a contribution. Oh, that's right, I forgot to mention. There is a link on the bottom of the show notes page where you can click and give us a contribution via PayPal. Any amount, small or large, would be appreciated. Even a dollar would be extremely helpful. I will mention the name of any person who makes a contribution to the podcast, unless you tell me otherwise. Also, I have a special offer, which is open to all of our listeners. If you contribute $5 or more, I will substitute your name for the name of an anonymous or unidentified person or reporter from an actual old-time newspaper article. If you make a $5 or more contribution, I will then contact you to find out if there's any particular type of article that you would prefer. One last thing. I would love to hear your comments, opinions, ideas, thoughts, and anything else that you might like to say in regard to any episode or the show in general. So, with that in mind, our email address is forgottennewspodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to type that as all one word. There are no hyphens, or dashes. So, for email, just to be clear, you type Forgotten News Podcast as if it were all one word. We also have a Facebook page. You can find it by using the search bar on Facebook and just typing Forgotten News Podcast. Three words. Now, there's not a lot of activity there at the present time because we are a fairly new podcast. But by joining, you can help to jumpstart things on Facebook, and I hope you will. We are also on Twitter, but our Twitter handle is @newsforgotten and not Forgotten News. Originally, I wasn't sure if we were going to do very much on Twitter, but for some reason, we were actually doing more activity on Twitter than any other social media other than the podcast itself. And like I said, our Twitter handle is @newsforgotten. So, anyway, long story short, please feel free to use any of these methods to contact us and to give your input or anything else that you might want to say. Finally, I encourage you to take a look at our show notes for each episode. And as far as I know, every listening platform that carries our podcast also includes our show notes in one way or another. If you have trouble finding our show notes, or if you just have no idea what I'm talking about, simply send me an email and I will send you a direct link. Well, with all that having been said, goodbye everyone. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
Thank you for listening to the Forgotten News Podcast. You will now be returned back to the present day, and we hope that we can count on you to join us for our next episode.
Our civilization has decided, and very justly decided, that determining the guilt or innocence of a human being is a thing too important to be trusted to trained men. If it wishes for light upon that awful matter, it asks men who know no more law than I know. When our society wants a library cataloged, or a solar system discovered, or any trifle of that kind, it uses its specialists. But when it wishes anything done, which is really serious, it collects 12 ordinary men standing around.